everybody. Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, it's luthier extraordinaire Aaron Green comes down from Massachusetts to Greenpoint, Brooklyn, the northmost tip of Brooklyn, where I live in my little two-bedroom apartment like a fat cat over here. I'm hanging out in one of the bedrooms right now, which we've converted into a living room. And it's got a door. It's a living room with a door in New York City. You know what that is? That means that when people come and visit, I already had one person visit. Caroline's parents are going to come and they're going to visit. They can stay in their own space. They can have an argument. They could discuss plans. They can stay up later than me. They can go to bed earlier than me. And it's a great space. You know, and I tried to fix it up the best I could. I'm not really a handyman. I'm more of like a clean man, very clean person. But I don't know, handyman stuff. You don't move to New York to be a handyman, do you? Right? I don't know. It's handyman stuff is just, I think it's a distraction, right? Like people that build decks or like weatherproof decks or, you know, all I can think about is decks right now, but I know that you guys do more of that stuff. But that's all just distraction. That's escapism in the same way that, like, you know, movies, books, or video games, or board games, or any, you know, sports. Yeah, nerd stuff is always the same. Nerd stuff is just stuff that people get into a lot, and they don't let it go. So I consider all this, I consider sports just as nerdy as Dungeons and Dragons. Well, maybe not just as nerdy, but I mean, the difference is I think sports is kind of cool because it doesn't cost money. It doesn't cost that much money to watch a game. It's kind of the cheapest sort of escapist thing you can do, but it is certainly escapist because there is absolutely no logical reason why you would sit there on Sunday of all days for 4 hours ignoring everybody so that you can, you know, support a team which will never, ever give you anything of any value back unless you use it to, you know, create something of value, like, you know, having people over, which is important. Having something. What's going on? Oh, LinkedIn. Oh, you got, oh, look at this. We got something from LinkedIn. These worthless pieces of garbage. Let's see what they got. I'm telling you, this job, I'm going to die at this job. I can't. I'm going to finish out the year and that's it. So I'm on LinkedIn. Let's see what LinkedIn's got. LinkedIn, worthless. Okay, so this is what it said. This is, they said 4 new results for podcasts, right? Because I entered podcast broadcaster. You know, I'm trying to get a job that way. Slate, account executive. What? Ad ops specialists at Scripps. Digital intern, business development intern. I mean, this seems like a bunch of, gray suit stuff. This is the ad operations specialist is an important part of our sales support team. They're not going to want me. Yeah, that's a problem with being 40 now. I'm 40. And I tell you, on paper, it just looks bad on paper to be 40. They don't understand how I can apply to the Slate job with, I don't know what's going on. Submit application. Not now. Okay, so I applied for the job at Slate because they had something called IN, you know, LinkedIn Easy Apply. Everybody else, I don't know, I'll get around to it. Sales jobs. I don't want to be in sales. I don't want to be in sales. If I'm going to sell something, I want to absolutely want to sell it, right? I don't know. I just don't like things enough to sell them. Anyway, what am I talking about? I'm talking about people that, you know, the handyman. I'm not a handyman because I moved to New York. Is that what I was talking about? Or nerd stuff? I'm a nerd. Yeah, well, the handyman thing is another way. That's another fixation that you get. You get the people that do that so they can escape their wife and kids. You know, they're sorry. They can't hang out. They got a deck to build. They got to weatherproof the deck. They wish they could talk to their wives, but instead they got to weatherproof the deck. It's all the same thing. And video games to me were the way, it's a decision that I made probably was about 26 years old. I made it with Giacomo. I said, look at all this stuff we're buying. You know, we were buying like amps and guitar cases and all this stuff. And it was just consumer. You know, it wasn't real. We didn't really need it. It's not like we were traveling all over the world at that point. I'm certainly not doing that now. But the point is that I was buying stuff as if I was traveling around the world. Right? And so I said, look, there is a way to get the same sort of fix in a much cheaper way. This is supposed to be something that, you know, college kids can afford to do. So at that point, games were like $35. Now they're $60. But, you know, you get one of those every 2 or 3 months, big deal. It's a night out, not even. And then you've got something you can do, sort of get your mind off things in the same way that like model trains do for some people. Things that they don't take up space, which I've always enjoyed. That's a very New York, very important thing about New York, is that video games don't take up space, barely any space at all. Now it's all digital. And then that's it. That's what you get. And that's not as bad. It's like being like, I need a MacBook Pro. No, you don't. You don't need a MacBook Pro. If you're recording an album every 2 or 3 years, you know, take that money and spend it on some recording studio time with a friend that you trust. And you'll get a much better recording because, you know, he'll have or she'll have all the bells and whistles that you would have spent $40,000 on. They did it. And then you pay them $800 because, dude, I don't got a lot of money. You talk your poor friend who is, you know, trying to embark on a recording engineer job and, you know, making an album for you for, you know, $300, which is what inevitably happens. If you're thinking about going into the recording industry, that's what's going to happen to you. You're just going to end up hooking up your friends or having them try to lowball you. Anyway, you know, so to me, video games are kind of that good thing. Sports are great, but I think sports are, yeah, they take up a lot of time. I do spend a lot of time on the Mets, especially when I was, you know, single last year. It was sort of like something that I really enjoyed. Or when I was in a dysfunctional relationship, it was a great thing. I started started listening to the Mets on the radio. Now I'm rambling, but that's what you get. You get some rambling, right? You guys don't mind that. I would go to the park and I'd listen to the games on the radio, again, just to get out of the house and get out of my head. But that works. If you're ever having like a sort of a panic sort of a situation, you're kind of getting panicky, just listen to the radio. Listen to the radio. I don't know if you have to listen, not music, but if you can listen to some talk radio, it sort of takes you out of your head and then also just gives everything context. I don't know if that's useful information, but it was to me. I should say that with all this talk about video games, we are sponsored today by GameflyOffer.com/insider. That's GameflyOffer.com/insider. GameflyOffer.com/insider will give you one of three deals. All right, you can save 35% on a package for 3 months. It's $9.50 a month. You get one game. You can return it at any time, right? And then you you can play it. If you don't like it, you return it. You get another one. You don't like that one, you return it. You get another one. You finish one. You finish the story in the game. Return it. Get another one. All right, and this goes on and on and on to infinity. You could do it billions of times. I mean, you could basically take 3 months off of work and you could work your way through, let's say, six games, 80 games. Somewhere between 6 and 80 games, right? Sounds like a nice little Trump figure for you. It's somewhere between 6 and 80 games. It's fantastic. I don't want to do the voice. Anyway, so you can do that, or you can do 2 games or movies out at a time, right, for 3 months. That means you can have 2 games. Say you want a racer and a shooter. You want to shoot things. You want to race cars. You can't decide. So you get 2 games coming at you in the mail. You return them at any time you want. You swap them out. You do whatever you want with them. $13.50 a month for 3 months. You know how much games are if you buy them new? They're $60. So already the savings are, I mean, it's unbelievable. Or, and again, this is only if you go to GameFlyOffer.com/insider. Don't go to GameFly.com. Don't go there. Go to GameFlyOffer.com/insider so that I get a little piece of the deal. And I see a little bit of money. And then you get the games that you want. You can also get one game or a movie out at a time, a 30-day free trial. All right, so that's just a free game for 30 days. You have a month to try GameFly. It's $15.95 after that if you don't, you know, cancel. No late fees. Cancel anytime. All right, that's for listeners of this show who go to GameFlyOffer.com/insider. It's an exclusive deal. You also go to Richard Sage out there in Bayshore, New York. Get the guitar of your dreams, all right? Aaron Green, of course, is on the show. You should definitely figure out, take a look at his guitars. But if you want to try a bunch of guitars, go to Richard Sage out there in Bayshore, New York, and he'll give you the guitar of your dreams. And he'll also sell you some doodads, some strings, some cleaners, all that stuff, all right? That's Savage, S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. Also, go to GetBarkBox. Don't go to BarkBox.com. It's a porn site. Go to GetBarkBox.com, GetBarkBox.com/insider, and get a toy for your dog. I know you got dogs, all you guitarists out there. That's why it's a good thing to get a dog. Why have a kid when you can have a dog? You won't be able to afford to be a guitarist for very long if you have a bunch of kids. I can't tell you how many times one of the guys I work with at the school has said, "Ah, oh, God, I'm losing it. I would quit this job if it wasn't for this kid." And I'd start playing my jazz gigs again. I know you would, pal. You should have gotten a dog. And if you do get a dog, you can go to BarkBox. Don't go to BarkBox.com. Sorry. Go to GetBarkBox.com/insider and get some toys for your dog. Keep him happy. I'm telling you, one of my students had a BarkBox at their house, and I saw one. Now, I don't have a dog, so I'm not going to get one. I might get one. I might ask him. I might say, "Hey, I just want one. I want the fun of getting something in the mail, opening it up, having it be nicely, beautifully wrapped, having a bunch of stuff to play with. I can play with it. I like things that squeak that I can put in my mouth. I'll play. I'll chew on that thing till it turns into, I shred it up in my mouth. I'll eat it. The way dog food is this way too, I'll eat that too. If you don't have a dog, you can go to GetBarkBox.com/insider and you can eat the treats yourself. I'm sure they're delicious. I mean, you know, these things are made out of fish edible. It's edible. Right? GetBarkBox.com/insider. You guys aren't going to give the dog something that you wouldn't give a human. That's GetBarkBox.com/insider. So you can get the dog that you have because you can't afford to have a child, the toys and treats that it needs. What I was saying is I went to my student's house, opened this thing up. It was around Thanksgiving. So there was Thanksgiving themed toys and treats. So there's a little rubber turkey. And then there was a plush turkey toy. The rubber turkey was the cooked turkey that you would take out of the oven. And then the plush turkey toy was like a cartoon turkey. And the dog gets to play with that thing until he rips it to smithereens. Isn't that great? What a deal. So those are our three sponsors. We've got GameFlyOffer.com/insider, Savage Classical, all the time, Savage Classical, and GetBarkBox.com/insider. For all of our other supporters and sponsors, please go to my website, Brett Williams, BrettWilliamsMusic.com. You can donate on the right there. If you go to any of the subpages, the podcast page, the media page, listen to my quartet, stuff like that, you can go to the right there and you can donate to the show, or you can take a look and support one of our sponsors, okay? Anyway, that's it. This is a great conversation I have with a great guy. Let's talk to Aaron Green. So you're coming from Boston. How was the trip? It was bad?
No, it wasn't bad. I mean, any trip you make it to where you're going is a good trip.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's always the trick in the drive.
Do you like driving?
I do, actually, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me much.
Yeah, because you're driving, you're not taking the whole thing, but you know, you were able to find parking. How long did it take you to find parking?
2 seconds. I have actually fairly good parking karma, which probably means I'll never find another spot again.
But yeah, you can't talk like that. You know, you're gonna end up
I would knock on wood, but you don't want me making noise. So
I don't want you making noise.
You're gonna have to just eat that one.
You are. We actually cut the part out where I told you not to knock on things.
Okay.
And now I'm gonna have to edit this again. As far as the ride down, but you do the car, you don't like the train.
Well, the problem is I always have a bunch of guitars with me.
So yeah. Let's talk. What do you got today?
Well, a couple of beauties.
We have about like you said, $250,000 worth of guitars are in my room.
Yeah. Actually, I had intended to drop off the Fleta on my way, so in fact, it's more than that now.
Oh, okay, so this is a problem. So that was the thing. That's why we were going to be... Oh, because you were like, I got to unload this Fleta. I can't be driving all over the place.
Well, it's more of a convenience of a plan of attack.
Right.
I need to go see my colleague and client, Alan Watsky, in New Jersey, to drop off the Fleta so he can work some of his magic on the fingerboard.
What do you have him... So you have him doing action work then?
Well, actually, we had done a little bit of work on the instruments. It's incredibly clean for 1959.
The thing
looks like almost like the day it was made. But the fingerboard needs a little help. And the problem that you run into with guitars is often that, you know, there's multiple ways you can deal with a problem, but you have to take into consideration all the various factors. So in this particular guitar, it's got too much relief, and then it's got like a little ski jump over the body where the fingerboard comes
up. When you say relief, what do you mean?
Meaning the neck is bowing forward.
Okay.
More than I would like.
Mm-hmm.
The action's pretty much where I would want it, but the board needs some help.
Well, what year is the Fleta?
1959.
Okay, so this,
Yeah, it's the original board, the original frets. I mean, it's ready for a checkup.
What's this guy's name?
Ignacio Fleta.
Ignacio Fleta. We'll talk about him. That's something we should talk about. But as far as the luthier who's going to work on the...
Oh, Alan Watsky.
Alan Watsky. What's your relationship with him? Could you know Gary Lee out there?
I've met Gary, yeah. I mean, he's a very talented luthier. I've never really hung out with him too much, but he's a very nice guy and he builds a great guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. He's really on the scene and stuff, you know.
Definitely.
But as far as getting this guy to work on it, the reason that you're having him work on it is, like you told me yesterday, it's because he has a special way of gently bringing the neck back to its original position so that we can improve the action.
Well, basically, it's a technique that's been around for a long time, heating the neck to actually straighten it out. And it's got a bad reputation. It's actually, you know, my entire career I've always been told, oh, that doesn't work, don't even bother. And I had gotten into a discussion with Dave Collette at Guitar Salon International about a guitar, and he had said, you know, this technique, we do it all the time, or Urs Zelten does it all the time. Urs being a very well-known restorationist down on the West Coast. Well, he was on the West Coast. He's moved to Europe. But
this is a rare thing. Heating up the neck is a rare thing. Generally, we do...
But generally, you don't
shave down the frets and stuff like that to make up for the difference.
It's not that rare. It's rare in the classical world. I mean, I remember like when I was a kid, I had an electric guitar and I brought it to a repair guy, and that was one of the things that he did. And you know, actually, to be honest, it was a terrible repair. It was like one of the things that got me started thinking about maybe I should learn how to work on guitars.
So you're like, wow, there's not a lot of people.
I just paid this guy a lot of money and my guitar is still messed up.
Like a Guitar Center repair or something like
basically,
that.
Basically, yeah.
Even though those guys are getting better. You know, I mean, they're going to school and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that it's always catch as catch can. I mean,
some people that do it right and some people suck. Yeah.
Exactly. Alan is, I've known about Alan forever. He's an exceptionally good repair person and very busy, active repair guy.
Yeah.
I'm building him a guitar right now. He's also a musician.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm very excited to be building a guitar
for
another
Is he video. Blonde?
No.
About our age?
No, he's older. I'm putting him in his 60s.
Oh, okay, cool.
But he's someone I've known about. I remember actually calling him up when I was a much newer guitar maker. This would have been in the mid-90s and asking him questions about how to do fret work.
And he was gracious.
Mm-hmm. Very.
Oh, sweet dude.
But he's going to... this technique that I had spent my entire career thinking doesn't work, Alan says, I've been doing it forever and it works great. So he's going to do that to the Fleta. And then what will happen is I will take it back. I will pull the frets out and I will do the final bit of perfecting of the fingerboard.
Regular
one. Really, the thing I don't want to do is I want to minimize how much wood we have to take off, because I could take care of the instrument. Just my usual way would be pull the frets and play in the fingerboard, but it's already a pretty flexible neck, and I'm a little concerned about making it more so. So
right.
So we're gonna give it a shot and see how it works.
When you say flexible neck, what do you mean by flexible neck?
Well, it's not that it's thin. It's just it's kind of a V-shaped neck.
What is it made out of?
It's a Spanish cedar and ebony, the usual combination.
Okay,
you'd
cool.
see. But wood varies tremendously. Like some pieces of cedar are infinitely stiffer than others. And
right.
Fortunately, you never really know until you put the strings on.
I mean, as far as this technique is concerned, I mean, what? That's obviously something that you could do with a guitar that, you know, is not from the 50s.
Oh, sure.
Is not from one of the top three guitar makers of all time.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
So as far as,
well, that's why Alan does it all the time.
How scared are you? I mean, Alan does this with flautas all the time. I mean, I can understand if he does it with a Humphrey.
Right.
You know?
I'm not worried about it. No.
You know,
I
no
mean,
offense to Humphrey at
sure,
all. I'm
sure.
just saying,
I know
even at that point, even at the point of the $20,000, $30,000 guitar rage or Red Gate or whatever,
yeah.
anything like that, I understand.
Right.
But when you start going into the collectors, and sort of that's the debate you were talking about, is this, the debate, and this has always been an issue with me, is the issue of players and luthiers
right.
as a unit,
mm-hmm.
and I believe a pretty unified community, the
oh,
two
yeah,
of us.
Definitely.
And then the collectors.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of different, areas of
right.
contempt between the collectors and the performers, I think, at least from my point of view. And then from the point of view of a luthier or a repair person, it must be very frustrating because they want, like you had said, original condition. They want
right.
original parts. They want everything to be the way it was and almost had to have let nature take its course with the instrument
right.
rather than keeping it in good repair and keeping it playable.
Well, there's a, yeah, I mean, there's,
that's what
there's
the collectors
certainly,
are looking for.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a generalization, but yeah, I mean, the thing is that there's collectors and then there's players who have a lot of money
mm-hmm.
and, you know, there are people who are looking for sound first and foremost.
Right.
And then there's the ones who are relatively, it's kind of a question of education really.
Right.
They don't know how to assess an instrument. They don't know how to assess good work. They don't even know what's possible or why you would do that.
And they know what works in the antiques market.
Right.
And they know what works. And so they sort of apply that.
You have less to apologize for if the thing looks like the day it was made. You know? Of course, if it doesn't sound very good, you know, that's kind of
right.
a problem. And that's yeah. happened. I've gotten guitars that were literally purchased and stuck under a bed that turned out to be extraordinary guitars.
Yeah.
So there are examples out there. I mean, I've had a few come through my shop. A Fleta, I had a Hernandez y Aguado that looked like, we call them time machine guitars. It's just like, this looks like the day it was made. And it happens also to be an extraordinary instrument. Those are obviously fantastic because you don't have to worry about it.
No.
You know, if the guy can play, he's going to want it. And if he can't play, he's going to want it. But
have you seen any strains that go through the guitars that are able to maintain themselves in various environments and, you know, under various conditions over half a century?
Right.
We're talking here over half a century with the Fleta.
Well,
over half a century with the Hauser.
Yeah.
What's going on with the guitars that, I mean, I can't
the
imagine
ones that make
a guitar
it?
Lasting that long.
Right. Well, it's subject to how it's taken care of. So, you know, if it gets good care, it's kept in the right environment, then there's no reason why they wouldn't last for many, many generations. But that's been the hardest part. Like, I had one of the instruments that I sold was Ray de la Torre's Simplicio, 1931 Francisco Simplicio that was picked out for him by his teacher, Miguel Llobet. So a huge historic instrument. Like
right.
I mean, this was, you know, Ray de la Torre was a prodigy. He was
touched
Barcelona.
By Llobet. Yeah.
It was played by him. And then
yeah.
and then Ray de la Torre concertized on it for the first part of his career, toured all over the world with it. And it's an amazing instrument. You can hear it on my YouTube channel. But it did not survive unscathed in the slightest. It was full of cracks. And it had been restored on the West Coast by a luthier who, his name is escaping me, John Mello. You know, John Mello did it. And he did a great job. But, you know, what he started with was, you know, kind of a hot mess. And
right, a concert guitar. A guitar that had been taken on the road.
All over the place.
Right.
It had gone from every possible environment, you know, you could imagine, and it showed. But it still had the sound, and it still had the life in it. And
that's unbelievable. Yeah. What kind of wood was it? Was it spruce or cedar?
Yeah, spruce top, Brazilian spruce rosewood, top. pretty straightforward instrument.
Right.
But it, you know, it all worked very well together, and it was a surprisingly good instrument, given the condition it looked
yeah,
like.
It would never occur to me, even if I had a lot of money, to buy an instrument that old,
mm-hmm.
a guitar that old, because generally speaking, I don't know, generally speaking, I just know that my idea has been that the guitar is a kind of instrument with a thinner top,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, it degrades over time,
mm-hmm.
much easier than something with a thicker top like a violin.
Right.
So that's why violins make more sense to me,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know that much. It makes more sense that a violin would age well rather than a spruce top guitar. And in particular, the new guitars with the Lattice bracing and stuff like that,
right.
the really super thin ones,
yep.
Like the Australian
right.
guitars and stuff like that. Thinking about that aging, to me, doesn't paint a pretty picture.
Right.
So, I mean, what makes like a guitar from the 30s carry all the way through to 2017 and go, like you're saying, relatively unscathed sonically?
Well, the guitar and violin are different. The stress on a violin is, well, back that up, violins are basically better engineered.
Yeah.
I mean, from an engineering perspective, they're pretty much perfect because the tension of the strings is going straight down into the face of the instrument, as opposed to in a guitar where you tie it on the bridge and you have torque. And torque is infinitely more destructive than just straight.
Destructive to the frequency?
Destructive to the wood. I mean, it fatigues.
Okay.
You know, you have right. you have basically force now in two directions, which is down and, you know, and leveraging, as opposed to just on a violin because of the angle of the strings, and you've got the, you know, the bridge sitting in the middle. It's literally pushing just straight down.
Is that
down.
Why some of those old jazz guitars have that sort of
Yeah, exactly.
That
I mean,
pulls to the back of the guitar.
Yeah, and they are replicating that to a greater degree than you would find in like a conventional guitar.
Leave the face of the guitar alone, please, is the idea.
Well, it's just...
Or at least take
a
little bit of heat off.
It's just a different mechanism. Yeah. I mean, obviously, they're being played with a bow. So
yeah.
now you have, you know, that is a huge difference between pluck and release. So, you know, the guitar is perfectly designed for what it is. It's just not as easy to deal with, and nor is it as well designed to withstand, you know, the string tension.
What an amazing point, because you know you only think about woods, but when you actually think about string tension and really the function of the bridge
yeah.
on the two are very different. The function of the bridge on a violin seems mainly to be to transmit the frequency into the violin.
Yeah,
and the bridge is now serving a double function as a bracing for the strings.
Right,
and
the transmitter
of the sound,
yeah,
which is pretty screwed up.
Well, no, I mean it's not screwed up.
It's just it's not as elegant.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean the violin's also designed to be taken apart, which is
right.
That's the other reason why we have 400-year-old violins. I mean, all those instruments have been worked
it
on.
It is. I don't know that. How's that? The bridge comes right off.
Well, the bridge isn't even glued on, but
yeah,
I'm talking
right.
about being able to take the top and back off. You can disassemble a violin very easy because those glue seams are all exposed.
But the neck. No,
the neck is glued in, but or right. nailed in if it's original.
Ooh, what do you think about next? What's your just
yeah, yeah.
quick little side
okay.
side combo? Then we'll get back to the centrifuge of this. I don't know if I'm using that word correct. I'm not, but we're gonna go to the side here.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what I was. What were we talking about?
What's you were gonna talk about necks.
All right, so necks, removable necks. What
right.
what's it feeling? I mean, cause, you know, all these issues with necks all
right.
the time, all the time. Necks.
Yeah. No, it's a good idea. You know, it's not what you do, it's how you do it.
Okay.
Period.
Okay.
You know, I mean,
do you have removable necks?
I don't. But Tom Humphrey was the one who first introduced
Started.
Me to the idea on,
right.
on a classical. I mean, he wasn't the first to do it, not mm-hmm. by a long shot, but he was certainly the one in the classical world that I became aware of who was doing it.
He was the one that was really, I think, one of the first that really wasn't afraid.
Oh, no, Tom was fearless.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
Right.
Like, he just, you know, he had absolute confidence in whatever he was doing in
right.
that moment, which could be wildly different than what he was doing 5 minutes ago. I
yeah.
mean, the man changed his mind more than anyone I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I kind of consider him like Jackson Pollock of
yeah,
guitar makers.
Super
he just,
yeah.
just threw it up on the wall.
Very modern and very, yeah, just whatever.
Yeah, iconoclastic even.
Yeah.
No, he was. I went to his place in upstate New York. This was after he left Manhattan, and he was showing us how, you know, he had a bolt-on neck, And I remember being horrified at the time. But, you know, I mean, he says, Tom Humphrey. I mean, the guy's, yeah, you know, huge success. What are you going to say? A couple of years ago, so many years later, a guy brings us a Humphrey that had been horribly damaged in an accident. And it was his guitar. He bought it from Tom. He was a real player. It was his baby. And a mic stand literally just took a swipe out of the top, like made a mess of it. And it was interesting because what facilitated the repair of that guitar was the fact that we could take the neck off. And the reason it made the repair possible is because what we did is we took the neck off and then we stole the wood from the top underneath the fingerboard where it sat down on the top, underneath the you know, the whole Millennium fingerboard area there.
Right.
But we were able to, and we do that all the time, but what made it possible on that guitar was the fact that we could just pop the neck off, to take it off, took the wood, we patched it in the face and made it pretty much disappear. But it was because that wood was the same wood as the top. You know,
right.
To actually match wood.
So that's the way, that's an example of how you can...
Well, that was it was a benefit of that design that I had not even thought of. And when it happened, it was like, you know, we wouldn't have been able to make that a successful
amazing
repair if it weren't for that.
Right.
So, I mean,
how amazing for him to be thinking about the future?
Well, he just thought about it, I think, from
the perspective of keeping a guitar alive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Tom was definitely practical. And he there was a lot of things, I think, over his career he did that probably didn't work out. But,
absolutely.
You know, that one certainly did.
Yeah.
And why not?
Yeah, the Millennium model was the go-to model in the 90s, I feel like.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, no, he was hugely successful.
As far as, you know, you said you were horrified when you saw your first removable neck.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What was your, you know, coming back to it, what was your, who was your mentor? Who'd you work under?
Well, I started.
Did you go to Spain, or what?
I met my teacher when I was in high school. So I was 16 years old, and I ran.
He was like a woodworking teacher?
No, it was a guitar maker. Alan Carruth is his name.
Okay.
And he was. It was a folk festival that was being held in the high school that I went to. So during April vacation, this organization would rent out my high school and hold this big, you know, folk festival.
Yeah.
And I just happened to be walking downtown, you know, kicking around one day, and I saw a flyer and I picked it up and I was looking at it and there was, you know, his name exhibiting instruments at this. And I had already thought that I wanted to build guitars and had spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out how to learn. This was before the internet, so it was a lot more slow going trying to get any information. And it was, you know, I was making some progress, but you know, this was like, oh my God, how perfect is this? So I, you know, beelined it down to my high school and snuck in and, you know, went and checked out his guitars. And he turned out to be the perfect person at that point. He's Alan Carruth is his name, and he's one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met, without a doubt. He's incredibly generous. He's brilliant. And he's just, you know, he was the perfect teacher for me at that time, especially considering I was a teenager.
Right, and he was perfect. And was he making like electric guitars, steel string guitars?
He builds everything. I mean, that's right. The other thing about him as a luthier is his.
But when you're a kid, you know, you want to. You, when you're a kid, you want to come in. You don't want to see classical guitars.
Oh yeah, no, I had no interest in classical guitar at that point. I mean, I played electric
that's
guitar.
That's why you say he's perfect at that time.
Well, he was perfect in his personality.
Yeah, if you met
Tom Humphrey,
you would have been perfect for a high school kid.
I probably would have told myself to come back after I grew up a bit.
So
but
go ahead.
So I hung out with at his booth and pestered him and asked him to teach me, and he did. And I would then, once I got my driver's license, would drive down to his house and Friday afternoons and work on an instrument, which was literally getting thrown in the deep end. I had no woodworking experience. I had, you know, really no understanding of anything other than, you know, he would say, okay, do that now. And okay, I would do that. And okay, do that. Now, it took me about a year to build the first guitar. And over that course of time...
Man, a year.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know,
yeah,
Friday afternoons.
Sit, yeah. Right, yeah.
You know, I discovered that I really wanted to do this. And B, I really wanted to continue studying with this guy because he was such a fascinating guy. I mean, just...
What a gift.
Oh, it was an amazing gift. I mean, unbelievable gift.
Can you imagine how many more people would make guitars if there was a guy like that at their high school?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he just, yeah, I mean, he wasn't, he was, it was just one of those things where the stars aligned.
Right.
And he now teaches actively. He has, you know, guitar making courses, which I think is, you know.
One more time, what's his name? I always like saying the name of these.
Alan Carruth.
These hometown heroes.
Yeah, yeah. No, he is a hometown hero. As much as possible.
How to get people to look him up.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Alan Carruth.
Carruth, yep.
The real deal.
Very much so. The world needs more people like that.
That's
sure.
right. And what did he teach you as far as, I mean, what was like one of the main tenets?
You know, well, first of all, he's a very interesting academic. Well, he is in some sense. Yeah. I mean, he's on the forefront of acoustics research.
Great.
His teacher was Carlene Hutchins, who is a famous violin maker who was from Montclair, New Jersey. And she worked her entire life as an acoustician just trying to figure out how violins work and founded an organization called the Catgut Acoustical Society. Alan studied under her and kind of was taking her work and applying it to guitars. So when I met him, he was like publishing some papers on guitar acoustics and his work in practical application of them, actually like putting this knowledge to work.
Yeah.
So for me, it was an interesting mix because he's very much he's a folky, you know, if you had to tag him as something.
He was definitely the
freedom rider type in the 60s. Nice, nice. He did serve in the Navy, and lived with his wife and kids and built instruments for a living. But he was also doing this, you know, really important work, which is certainly the foundation for everything I know about how guitars operate.
Right.
You know, and to have that combination was pretty amazing. He's a very old world luthier, but he was also on the front line of this, you know, important work. So
I've had a couple of luthiers on the show. Would it be too dramatic for me to ask you how do guitars work?
How do guitars work?
Yeah. Would you be interested in
yeah, sure.
trying to explain that?
Yeah, I could.
Or
do my
I'm
best.
Sure you can explain it. You could do your best, and if you don't do great, that's okay. But I mean, I have my way of explaining to the kids how guitars work.
Right.
But how does an acoustic guitar work?
Well,
and how does classical guitar work as opposed to a steel string, because I think they work in very different ways.
Yes and no. I mean, the instrument is inherently very much the same. Steel strings are different than nylon strings.
You know, right.
There's a lot more energy to play with there. And the trick with a good steel string, as I understand it, is to get a good bass response.
Right.
In the classical guitar, it's the other way around. Getting the, you know, really powerful and even trebles is not so easy because of the nylon strings.
Right.
The guitar is, it's a contradiction in and of itself. Like, everything about the guitar is at odds with itself, acoustically speaking. So when you find an instrument that's really successful across the board, it's a guitar that's really alive, that is also really even, that has a broad tonal palette, that has a beautiful tone, that, you know, and a flexible tone, and all these things are kind of diametrically opposed in my mind. So it's that that's that balance between those opposites that is always the hard thing to achieve. And it's very much in the moment because you can't build the same guitar twice.
Well, yeah, the simple idea of having a beautiful low end to a tone, even if it's a tone on the first string, and having a singing and crisp high end.
Yep.
Those are two completely opposite goals.
In some sense, yeah. I mean, for me, I think about it more along the lines of,
and then balancing it is, I guess,
the balance. The balance versus tone versus flexibility is where all these things are.
But you kind of, it's not even a balance. It's a balance issue, but you want both.
Of course you do. That's what I mean by balance.
So it's like meeting in the middle is sort of like ho-hum.
Right.
You know, it's almost like.
Well, it's all of it representing full value in equal measure with itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a tough one.
Full value in equal measure with itself.
It's harmony. Right. It's perfect harmony. And that's always a tough thing to achieve. You know, when I said you can't build the same guitar twice, it's because every piece of wood is different.
True.
So when I'm building a guitar, my first thing I start with is as clear a picture of what it is I'm trying to do.
Right.
Like actually really visualizing the instrument and having a clear understanding of what it's going to be. And when I was, after a year of apprenticing with Alan, I went to the Guild of American Luthiers convention in 1992. And it was an amazing experience because it was the first time I ever met any other instrument builders besides my teacher. It was also where I discovered classical guitar and decided that's really what I wanted to pursue.
What made you decide that?
I was actually watching this guy play Bach. It was more watching him than anything. Watching it, you know, the gymnastics of his hands.
Complete use of the instrument.
Exactly.
Not just
picking
the top three strings on the 12th fret.
Or the first three frets.
Or the first three frets.
Yeah, no, this guy was, he was making real music, and it was phenomenal, and it was, it was a trip. And that was, I realized, okay, there's a challenge right there.
That's guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the people who was at that convention was Robert Ruck, who's a very famous American guitar maker, and he was giving a presentation on how to achieve sound.
That was, early 90s was like his shit.
Yeah, he was, he was one of the big, he still is one of the big boys. But it was an amazing lecture because I remember being kind of.
Is he like the big, what do you call it? What do you call that hole?
Oh, Soundports?
Soundport guy.
He was the one, Ruck was one, he did the two on either side, but he was kind of the first one to do it.
Yeah. On everything.
Yeah, I mean, there were some jazz guys like Linda Manzer and John Monteleone, who I remember seeing. The more what we used to, I guess what we think of as sound ports with the bigger port on the side, they were doing that on archtop guitars before anyone. But
a lot of innovation happening there.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Yeah. But the thing about Robert's lecture is it was coming from a very philosophical standpoint, which was different in presentation, anyways, from how Alan was teaching.
Yeah,
Alan
was very. You're like 19 years old at this point.
I had just turned 18, actually.
So you're blown away. You're in heaven.
At the whole event, yes. At Robert's lecture, not so much. Because I remember sitting there going, thinking this guy's a freak. I mean, I had no idea who he was.
Well, he's a fraud.
He's like talking about things that, sound like he should be in an ashram. And I'm like, I'm like, all right, whatever, dude.
Welcome to California.
Right. What he did say that really was, kind of got under my skin, and it was a very distressing thing to hear, was he talked about visualizing the guitar. He's like, I want you to sit there and think about, the most beautiful guitar sound. He's like, get it in every detail you can, and that's where you're going to go. That's what you're going to build. And I remember sitting there, and I'm like, I have no idea what that even is.
18, you're like,
it sounds like a guitar.
I'm going to party tonight.
Yeah, well, or just more, I realized in my own experience how limited I was. I was like, oh my God, there's
like your imagination is actually not.
My imagination was not up to the challenge,
right.
Because
I always think kids have the big imagination. I have a big imagination.
Well, you have to have a familiarity with what you're trying to do. Yeah, I mean, you have to know what it is.
Know what you're trying to imagine.
Exactly, right. And that was. I remember,
manifest destiny.
Exactly. Before that, I remember Alan playing a couple of guitars for me in his shop, and he's talking about the sound, and he can hear all sorts of differences. Yeah. To me, they both sounded like guitars. And I remember that was also distressing. I realizing early on that I had a lot of just learning. I needed to learn what was out there and what the differences were. Now,
before you could even have fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what brought me to New York, originally, too.
Where are you from originally?
Well, I'm from Massachusetts.
Okay, but good. So you go out to California just for the lecture.
Well, the that thing was in South Dakota, but that was a convention.
Okay.
But Robert had come out, and as I said, he really kind of gave me, kind of using a Zen term, I mean, a koan. He's like, here you go.
Right.
Work with that. You sit with that for a while.
What's a koan?
Koans are mind benders. They're basically designed to break out, through a linear way of thinking.
And bring out the meta in the situation. What are you going to do?
Yeah, like what's the sound of one hand clapping?
Right.
I mean, it's not about the answer; it's about the process.
Right.
So, and that was exactly, take this guitar sound in your mind, and then go and do it.
You're like, how do you do that? I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, you got a long way to go before you can even begin.
Right. Sure.
So it was, but it was a great gift in the end because that really did get me to the point of realizing that I needed to go out in the world and start playing a lot of guitars, and coming to New York and meeting great guitarists and, really kind of going into the deep end of the pool, which is what my first, few years here was all about. I mean, I would just come to New York and have my head handed to me on a plate. Go home, spend 6 months, come back with another guitar, have my head handed to me on a plate, go home.
Who would hand you your head, like a player?
Oh yeah, all of them.
They'd be like, this just doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, some were nicer than others, but yeah, definitely it was.
And when was that? What year was that?
It'd been 95.
Okay, so 95, you come to New York and you get your ass handed to you.
Multiple times for years.
Well, because by the time I ran into you, it was probably 2004, 2003. You were selling guitars to kids in Manus.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Paul Smith.
Yep, Paul Sylvia, Smith. That's right.
Did Sylvia have one?
No,
yeah, no.
I don't think so. But Paul was definitely a client. I think he still has it. I hope.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, he does. I'm sure.
He's
yeah.
a good guy.
Yeah.
No, for me, it was really like, okay, I'm gonna go and just, you know, I can take it. It was like a masochistic thing. Like, just, all right, let me have it, you know? But at the same time I was, you know, all right, fine. Let's see a guitar that, you know, works to the way that you want to see it. And then I would be studying instruments and I'd start to understand, at least in the case of that particular instrument, how it was working with itself. Like, what was it that was, you know, trying to, it's a non-linear process. It's not like, do this, you get that.
But your idea is like listening to someone. So you went to a lot of concerts then.
Sure. Yeah. And studied a lot of guitars.
Which is what Gary, you know, I'm pretty close with Gary and I don't want to push Gary too much because, you know, you're way better than Gary is at making guitars.
I don't know about
I'm
that.
Just totally okay, playing Gary. Say. Totally playing Aaron sucks. No, but so the thing is that you...
the check's in the mail.
but the thing is that... and you're a great guitar maker. I've always liked your guitars. You know that.
Thank you.
But the thing is going in, he had explained that he does. I mean, he has always at all the shows in New York, and just as much as he can. And all it is just like it's the job. He's got to go.
Yeah,
he's got to see what works and what doesn't work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, I'm starting to do that again.
Because if you just get in your own head into your own guitars, you're like, oh, it sounds beautiful.
Right.
And then you go and you give it to somebody. The humility of that situation, coming back around, rounding it back to 1995 in New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, how'd you deal with that? I mean, you put so much work into these instruments. I mean, these instruments, you know, like you said, a year for your first one. You know, from wood, from, you know, purchasing wood to, you know, sanding down the saddle.
Yeah.
We're talking a lot of time.
A lot of time.
A lot of time.
A lot of effort.
Yeah. And a lot of effort and a lot of care.
Yep.
And a lot of decisions that you thought were so intelligent.
Well, or I mean, you know what? It's like, you know, the physical act of building a guitar is very straightforward. I mean, you follow the process.
You follow the book.
Yeah, or you know, there's a methodology to it, but the results are can be any. I mean, it's literally like walking in the dark with a candle.
It's never fun to do something so long and work so hard on it, and then try and sell it, and then someone says, "I don't want to buy it."
Or even, I mean, I've had every possible experience you could imagine in that regard.
I know guitarists, and especially the older, more opinionated dudes that are just like, think it's their job to spank everybody.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
They come from that old Segovia school.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yep.
You know, they're just like, my job is to make sure that the truth is told.
Yeah.
And it's like, well.
I mean, without like I said, it's a masochistic, you know, endeavor. and it, very quickly I recognized this. Such as, you know, to be blunt, I was like, all right.
So,
it's like, I'll take it, you know,
right,
your hand is going to get tired.
Yeah. That's how I feel too. That's how I feel with them too.
And for me, it wasn't even about, you know, making sure that they're
like Barry Lyndon, where you just get spanked over and over again.
I wasn't trying to change their mind. It was more, you know, as long as what was coming was genuine, like they actually knew what they were talking about.
Right.
All right, fine. You know, however the delivery is, it is. I mean, you know, I didn't come here to get pat on the head. But the ones who I'm closest to, of course, were the ones who were a little more gentle about it.
Right.
You know, even if they're merciless at the end of the day, it's, you know, I want the truth. I don't want to have to make excuses for my guitars.
It hurts, and you get over the hurt.
Yeah.
You get over the hurt of the truth.
Well, like I said, also, it became almost like a game. I just was like, all right, fine, you know.
Yeah. Any sort
what do you got? Is that all you got?
Any sort of you know, critique, is always met with me with like an initial response of defense.
Sure, of course.
And then a day later or 2 days later, I'm like, I think I really do need to practice my skills.
Yeah, you know? There you go.
You know,
I mean, you know,
when a friend said that to me, he's like, I think you just maybe need to do your skills. I was like, you think what? You?
Yeah.
What do you mean? I need to do my skills. And then before you know it, I'm doing my scales every day for a year.
Yep.
And then I get really good.
That's, you know, criticism is...
Burnt for days. I was like, how dare you?
Yeah. No,
that's
true.
I was like, I don't do my scales.
It's, you know, I remember getting a letter from another guitar maker when I was, you know, still starting out, I was probably even still a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, I think you really need to pay attention to your aesthetics. And I remember being burnt for days. Like,
Jesus.
Tell me my guitars are... She basically
tell me they're
just
ugly?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Your guitar is ugly and you suck. You know, and I'm just like...
Oh, my God.
Well, that's... You know, but that's... She was right.
And then, yeah, so what changes have you made? You made changes to the rosette?
Oh, well, it was... You know, I mean, the thing is that... I mean, so... Workmanship and you know, such as a guitar could be analogous to like technique as a guitarist. Mm-hmm. It's a vehicle. It's not really the end of the road by any stretch of imagination, but if you don't have it, you know, you're pretty much not going to get anywhere. Yeah. So, I mean, I just, yeah, I mean, my people...
That hurt because you knew it was important.
Well, I just knew it was true. No, but I started making excuses. I'm like, well, I'm only 19. I'm like, oh, shut up, Aaron. You know?
Right.
It was a come to Jesus. And, you know, shit, what can I say? I mean, people generally are pretty complimentary about my workmanship now. I take it because, you know, I put a lot of effort to get there. But that's really not, you know, certainly the trick in being a guitar maker. You know, in building good instruments, it's not about getting nice mitered purflings and a perfect shiny finish.
And perfectly laid tiles. Into
exactly,
the reset,
yeah.
Right?
That's, you know, and workmanship standards have evolved tremendously, even in the time that I've been in a guitar maker.
I think we also have had situations where, you know, people's guitars, there's ways to do it now where there are not, I don't see quite the ornate rosettes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And stuff happening that I saw even 20 years ago. Like, it seems like people are kind of starting to find more elegant ways of expressing themselves. You
I
know?
Mean, as an aesthetic, yeah. I mean, there's that. I mean, I would... I mean, my rosettes can be... I've done some incredibly...
intricate, tiny ones.
Or, you know, ornate rosettes.
Right.
And then some that were, you know, much more reserved, if you will.
Right.
In a lot of ways, from an aesthetic perspective, the simpler the guitar, the harder.
The simpler the guitar,
the harder it is to pull off
ornaments.
Effectively, because there's nothing to hide behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you at that point you're basically, you know, kind of naked.
Yeah. You remember like Burnaby and stuff like
that.
Yeah, very very beautiful.
Yeah, and well, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Right.
Burnaby's aesthetics, especially, you know, his earlier days were the Spanish builders back in that time period really had.
You really felt like you were getting a sword, you know,
exactly.
When you got a Burnaby or something. You saw somebody with it, you're like, that's.
Oh, yeah.
That's what you spend money on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, but then, you know, you hear other guitars and, you know, or you see people have problems with certain aspects.
You know, I mean...
I always like Burnaby's, but, you know.
I do, too. I had a great one from 1970 that I sold a little while ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, a great one. Yeah, when that would have been his first year really on his own. I think he left for Ramirez in 1969 and, you know, set up his own shop. And he built, I mean, Burnaby as a luthier, I think, is one of the most underrated luthiers.
In the world.
I mean, the thing that he did that...
yeah, I don't see people playing him a lot.
Well,
I saw them in Texas, and I saw two of them come through.
Yeah.
And they were my favorite guitars.
Oh, yeah. No, he was a genius. I mean, he could do things...
And then people got rid of Steve Castellan, got rid of his, and I was like, why'd you do that?
Yeah.
Because I can't afford it, and I'll never hear that guitar again.
He would do things bracing wise that I would never try. Like I would just say, I can't pull that off, and he would do it, and it would work. And he was really one of the greats. The two things that happened with Burnaby, first of all, that kind of guitar has fallen out of style, if you will. The Madrid, you know, the big long scale.
Right.
I mean, anything over 650 now, everybody gets, you know, I mean, no offense, kind of their panties in a bunch.
Right.
It's really true, and it's kind of annoying.
I don't even know. So you're talking about the
scaling,
of the neck.
Yeah.
And then right now, that's how. What's the difference between that and the standard?
Well, the Ramirez Madrid school was a 664, and that's, you know, that's a half inch longer than a 650.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that there's so many factors that go into why a guitar plays well. Scale length is one of them, but it's not the end all be all. There's how you shape the neck. There's the setup. There's, you know, the tension of the guitar itself. Burnaby's generally are longer scale guitars, so that's already a problem for a lot of people. The other is that he had kind of a factory thing going on. So the question around him is, well, is that a real handmade by the old man, or is that one that was built by other people, or was it, you know, as a colleague of mine calls it, a label licker, you know, where it was built somewhere else entirely, and it just happens to say Burnaby because he sold it through his shop.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about him is he died probably one of the wealthiest guitar makers who've ever. Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure in his case, he probably was, you know, smiling all the way to the bank. But it hasn't done his...
Well, I've never heard any of this.
It hasn't done his reputation a lot of good in posterity.
Right.
Which is unfortunate because, right. you know, when he got it, he got it. I mean, he was one of the greats, in my opinion.
When he made a guitar. But when he's having...
Well, I mean, I've seen other ones that were nice, but, the ones that were I could definitely ascribe to him generally are pretty amazing instruments.
Right.
And he was very... he understood how to make a guitar work.
Yeah. So,
and that's, you know, that's the part that's transferable.
But he did have that reputation. I had no idea about that. I haven't even said his name for about 15 years.
Yeah, I think his son is Bill. So Bernabe right. still exists, but, you know, Paulino Sr., who died, I think, like maybe over 10 years ago.
Yeah, right.
It's been a while. But, yeah, he was a brilliant, brilliant luthier, no doubt about it.
Who are your favorite? As far as the guitars that you've heard, I mean, do you feel comfortable discussing
sure.
who your favorite makers are?
Yeah.
I mean, you can even go back to, you know, the Japanese people or whatever you want. I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, who?
Well, I mean, for me, the reason I'm a dealer of vintage guitars is right. because I study these instruments. I mean, that was always the whole point.
You ever play the Kono? Am I saying?
Kono?
Yeah. Did you ever play those?
Mm-hmm.
The originals?
Yep. Yeah, he was a good builder.
Yeah.
Very good builder. I mean, he went to Spain and I think was hanging out with Hernandez y Aguado. I think that was who he was originally influenced by.
Working with, yeah.
I don't know if he worked with him, but I know he's certain. Arcángel Fernández, mm-hmm. I think, was in there somewhere. But of historic builders, Boucher, Hauser, you know, those guys are...
I'm talking about Boucher.
Well, Boucher is an interesting example because he was, he started building late in life. I think he was probably about my age when he started. Mm-hmm. He was a painter. He was never a professional guitar builder. Mm-hmm. He was always an amateur. And by that, I mean, he just never did it for a living. He was, you know, he taught painting.
Yeah. Let's talk about the guitars that you have here today. So
sure.
you have a Boucher.
Yep.
A Bernabe. No, yep. not a Bernabe.
A I have Fleta. Fleta, Boucher, Hauser, and then one of mine.
One of yours.
Yeah.
All right. So go for it. Let's talk about it. So let's go with the French guy.
Yeah, as the French guy. The French guy is... So, I mean, Boucher was... I'll tell you a really fast, funny story.
Sure.
In about 10 years ago or 12 years ago, I sold a guitar to this older gentleman who I met at the Ben Verderi's Yale Guitar Fest.
Sure.
That was probably the last time I actually displayed guitars at a guitar festival.
Uh-huh.
And this guy came by and played my guitar and then called me up and said, you know, I'd like to come up to your shop and see that guitar again if you still have it. I said, yeah, of course, come on up. And he's a lovely guy, just one of the nicest, you know, sweet dude. And he's playing my guitar, and as I said, he's an older gentleman, and he stopped after a while and said, you know, I want to buy this guitar. So that's fantastic. He said, I haven't bought a new guitar in 50 years. And I was like, and for some reason, just there was something about him that, you know, I just assumed that this was like his first good guitar. You know, so I said, well, what's your other guitar? And he said, oh, it's a Boucher. It's like, whoa, okay, really? And he started telling me that he had been a student in Paris in the 50s under Christian Aubin, who was a very well-known teacher in those days, and he needed a better guitar. So this guy's, his teacher says, why don't you call up my friend Robert? He builds guitars. And this was, you know, pretty early on in Boucher's career. He was definitely an accomplished guitar maker at that point, but he was not, you know, this unbelievably famous dude yet. So this guy, as a young 20-year-old kid, hung out in Boucher's shop and watched him build him his guitar, which,
yeah.
you know, is kind of amazing. I mean, he had
right.
this, you know, friend, Daniel Friedrich was coming around in those days as a young student as well and showing guitars to Boucher for his approval. So, I mean, he was kind of at the inception of the birth of the French guitar world.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, and that to me was, you know, an amazing, I loved talking to him about those days because I'm sure living in Paris in the 50s must have been pretty awesome for an American kid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. With the film.
Yeah, I know.
And the colleges. Oh, my God.
Yeah, Paris is...
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, the thing about Boucher is he didn't build many instruments. I think there's about 150-something of them known to exist. And he quickly devised his own bracing pattern. So the ones from the 50s are pretty much a straight up Spanish guitar, and then he went and did his own thing entirely, which was kind of revolutionary in some ways. It was a big bar that's underneath the bridge to support the top, and it changed the sound of the instrument rather dramatically.
What's the bar made out of?
It's spruce, but it's a brace that literally is glued across the top underneath the bridge, and it's called Boucher bracing.
So it's a big spruce, like it's a big piece of wood. It's not like a little.
I mean, relative to the size of the fan braces, it is a big piece of wood.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he inspired a lot of other builders. David Rubio, who was in New York for the most important part of his career, by most people's estimation, became familiar. You know, he started building guitars inspired directly from Boucher because Julian Bream had a Boucher in those days. And Bream brought him his guitar to have him work on it. And while he was there, Bream said, you know, you ought to build a couple like this.
Oh, wow.
And so Rubio did and created his own model that was inspired by Boucher, then Bream took and then recorded 20th Century Guitar Music on his 65 Rubio, and Rubio went off to, you know, this stellar career as well. I mean, Boucher influenced a lot of people. He certainly, all the French builders are indebted to him, but also the Granada builders. He became friends with Marin Montero, who was a much younger guitar maker in the 70s. And Marin Montero is kind of the dean of that whole area. And he started building Boucher-inspired guitars, which was a huge change for him at that point. And that whole region is basically inspired by Boucher now.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, wow. He definitely affected a lot of people.
And a lot of that is because of Bream.
Well, of course. You know, Bream had a lot to do with it, you know. Right. But Ida Presti also played
Ida
Boucher.
Ida Presti, okay.
Yeah. Who else played?
Just the big Boucher. Players in the 50s, then.
Yeah, pretty much.
Even like, that's great, man. That's cool.
Yeah, he was definitely a.
And you have it. You have it.
I have one.
And
of
you have
best
one
ones.
That was picked up in Paris.
Well, it must have been. I mean, it's from 1969, but right. I mean, it came to me through the owner is in this country, but he called me up and said, "I want to sell it." Okay, fine, send it up. And it's one of those like, oh my god, this is
a real deal.
It's one of the best guitars I've ever played.
Cool.
It's super alive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got generations of life left in it.
What are your feelings about the Hauser? Hauser 1.
He was not so bad.
Not so bad, right? Segovia's guitar?
Yep. Hauser was directly inspired by Santos Hernandez and Manuel Ramirez and Torres. So it's kind of a continuation of that lineage.
Right.
But he managed to create within that framework a sound that is, you know, we call the Hauser sound. It's very aristocratic, very disciplined, which is very German. And,
right.
And they're, you know, exceptional instruments. The one I have here, which is from 1940, has had a pretty, you know, long life, and she's been restored by us and is an exceptional instrument. It's very similar to the one that Bream was playing with at the end of his career, which was the Rose Augustine Hauser. Mm-hmm. And this one sounds very much like that guitar, which is kind of unique in the Hauser world. And Hauser, you think of kind of like a silvery, a very clear sound, and maybe a little cold. Bream's comment about the Hauser guitar is it'll do whatever you want it to do, provided you know how to do it.
Yeah.
Which is to say it's an incredibly transparent instrument. And transparency in an instrument can be a wonderful thing in the hands of a right player.
Right.
You know, someone who really has a clear idea of what they're trying
to
say.
Well, and has a good tone.
Well, of course, has a good tone, understands how to get tone, how to understand shades, colors, nuances, all that stuff. This one is a little darker than your usual Hauser. It's got a more of a velvety kind of response.
Oh, how much fun.
Oh, it's stunning.
It's a good, good.
I love it.
Good
guitar. It's one of my favorite guitars.
And then you also got the Fleta. Now, you were talking about Fleta in the beginning. You want to pick up on that real quick? We're kind of coming to the end here, too, but, you know, I just want to make sure we talk about these guitars. I thought that'd be a fun thing to end on.
I mean, we're coming to the end of the...
Okay. We'll definitely talk about, you know, if there's anything else you want to talk about, we can talk about that, too. But
sure.
For now, let's talk about the Fleta.
Fletas are, you know, Barcelona. He's one of the people who kind of broke away and started doing his own... thing. I mean, he created a
what did
design.
He do that really separated him from
well,
the
well his guitars
these
are
the, these are the guitars
they're very unique
that
I mean,
you have always that I've in my lifetime I have always heard of as a very expensive guitar. I mean, a Hauser's a collector's item,
yeah,
but it's a Fleta is a concert guitar that's still used that is from my memory, was the first time I heard about a guitar that was that expensive.
Sure.
Like a $100,000 guitar or whatever.
Well, Flayed, they're not quite that high, but they're definitely, they can be extraordinary instruments. Yeah. He created his own design. So he was one of the people, much like Boucher, who kind of, took all of the work that had been done in design of guitar and did something unique with it. So his guitar shape is unique, his bracing pattern is unique, and it is a flauta. It's like, a Guarneri or a Stradivarius or something. It's unique to him.
Yeah.
And people copy that design pretty successfully. And it is a kind of a pianistic guitar. I mean, all these things were done generally to improve the horsepower of the instrument.
Right.
And they were definitely a significant leap forward in that direction.
When you mean horsepower, you mean just loudness.
Volume.
That's what's going on. Is the flight that does it have a truss rod in it? Or,
no.
So it's just straight up guitar, but it's loud.
That was the point of the design, was to increase the, make it more of a concert instrument.
Without screwing around with the way we make guitars.
Hopefully. I mean, there's nothing artificial in it. There's no, synthetic materials or anything like that. But, everybody is, as a builder, always trying to, improve, try to create a new, something that hasn't been done
before. Well, and that brings us to our last builder who's here today, Aaron Green. And what do you do that you, have you done anything that you find particularly innovative?
I think a lot about how to improve my instruments without losing what I like about them, the sound, the tone, the flexibility. It's easy to innovate in a direction where, you're just going after one thing, like more volume, for example. And part of the problem I have with modern guitars is that they've gained some, change in horsepower and volume. They've got more of it. Mm-hmm. But it generally is at the expense of tone. And a lot of the modern guitars, I just don't like the way they sound.
Right.
And I think that's a real problem.
A lot of people describe it as metallic.
Metallic, Ethel Merman. That's the way I think about them. I was like, wow, that's not a sound I want to hear, and there's a lot of it.
Nasal.
Nasally. It's just not flexible, one-trick pony. I mean, one-trick pony is really the problem. I mean, to me, the hallmark...
Because people were always like, I want a balance... There's a lot of, I think it's a lot of it, and this is kind of comes back to what you said at the beginning. A lot of it is Bach playing.
Yeah.
Bach playing is wonderful. It's great.
Yeah.
It is unique in the sense that, you are not always going to be using every part of the guitar all the time. Generally speaking, if you're an effective concert guitarist, you are going to be kind of playing almost like a rock person. You're going to have a lot of expressive need for the 10th fret, and less for the 9th fret of the 5th string.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, there's two things going on. There's the fact that guitarists themselves are, I think, a lot of the younger guitarists, and this is changing and I'm very happy for it, but for a while there I was really feeling like the academic approach to guitar playing and also the competition approach to guitar playing.
Right,
like,
competition, right.
You know, they have
make
to
it
play...
so you can play it fast.
Play it fast, play it clean, and where's the music? Right. And that's been a huge criticism of mine. Like I said, I'm very happy to say that I'm noticing a big shift away from that. I mean, it's real. There's a lot of younger players out there who are playing with a great deal of expression and soul.
Going old school.
I love it.
A little bit of tone, a little bit at the expense of tone, a little bit. And I love these new players. I think it's definitely a new era, for sure.
And they're also playing more traditional guitars.
Whereas people that are my age, your age, it's like the idea was the John Williams model of letting the music play itself through you.
Yeah, I guess that would... I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way, but I mean, like I said, I think that the competition mindset is really the problem. That it has pushed a style of playing which is solely to, impress other guitarists.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem. When you go to a guitar concert and the only people in the audience are other guitarists... or guitar aficionados.
Right.
That's a problem.
That's a huge problem. No, in my opinion too.
And I think that by bringing back that style, or a new version that hasn't lost like what Bream did and what Segovia did that was so effective at bringing in larger masses.
That's why I like Elliot Fisk.
Yeah. Me too.
And people have issues, and I don't. I don't mind someone just throwing the thing around a little bit and spanking it.
Yeah. Well, you know? Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing about Elliot that really, I mean, I've known Elliot for a long time, and I admire him tremendously. It's an interesting thing. I've heard him play many times. You know, just in his living room, or when I go and see him at NEC or something, and he can out Segovia Segovia.
Yeah, he can. He's basically Segovia 2.0.
I mean, in my opinion, I've heard him do some things, you know, musically on the guitar that I've never heard anyone else do.
I've heard him at his age. I've seen him do physical things.
Yeah.
That I can't imagine anybody else doing. It's surreal.
It is. I mean, but I think the people who, when they hear him in concert, he has his concert persona. I think this is where the criticism from other guitarists comes
from. I've heard people call his tone grotesque.
Yeah, well, I've heard him make some of the most beautiful sounds you've ever heard.
Me too.
So
he might be my favorite. I don't know. I don't want to say that, actually. I'm going to delete that part.
But. All right. Well, no, I mean, I think, but what it is that Elliot, not to analyze a guy, but he came up, you know, in an era where he was doing something new. He was breaking new ground.
Right.
And I think in some sense it's gotten, at least in maybe people who don't know him or haven't heard him in that context of just playing for the sheer beauty of playing, they don't realize that, you know.
Well, he almost marketed himself as like this, the Segovia's favorite young guitar. Like he wanted to be that. Or it seemed like that was the way it was marketed. He was this old school guitarist.
Yeah.
And then you see him and he's this perfectly modern guitarist.
Oh, very much so.
You know?
No, I think that, you know, one time he described himself to me as a race car driver.
Yeah, and he's got the ascot, and he's got the whole Spanish thing. He speaks Spanish.
He speaks a ton of language.
Yeah, so you just think like, oh, well, this guy is like doing the Spanish. No way, dude. You get into that concert, it's like a whole world.
No, he's a genius. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. But, you know, the thing, is that what I've been fortunate enough to hear is when he has just played, expressively in that kind of style, the older style, I mean, that he can really do that better than anybody.
He can do it, and he can do it in the context of new music.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he's a
genius,
we've
really talked a lot about Elliot Fisk and
old guitarist.
And Gary Lee. Who's not as good as you are. That's not true. Gary Lee is fine. Gary Lee would give me anything I ask.
Hmm? You will? Wise.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. He should give me a little bit. But we're talking about you today. Is there anything else that you want to say real quick? Not real quick. You say take your time.
Take my time?
Yeah. Is there anything you got going on?
I got a lot going on.
You got any workshops coming up this summer you're going to offer?
I'm thinking of doing some guitar shows this summer. Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I'd like to do the Manish show. I need to get back into
doing Come down that. To the Manish. I'm there. Yeah,
I need to do that. The last time I did GFA was in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
I basically got tired of that side of guitar making.
I can't fly.
You can't?
Well, I can. I just don't have money to go. I don't want that to be my vacation.
Oh, yeah. I don't blame you there.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't.
I got one vacation a year, basically, and I don't want to have it be me hobnobbing with people that aren't going to help me anyway.
There you go. If you're not bringing me a drink.
If I want to go to a show, I'll go to a show here.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just, the guitar, to show guitars at a guitar festival like that, I always had a real hard time with because it's a very competitive, very nasty environment.
It's not fun.
And frankly, you know, the guitarists that you're there to really try and show guitars to are interested because they're trying to, you know, compete. They've got a full plate.
Yeah.
But I do need to start doing more of that. So you'll start seeing me around.
Well, you and I have the same thing where I think we kind of like, we're focused on the work and we don't necessarily get out as much.
You know.
Anyway,
But, you know, in terms of what I'm doing, the restoration work is a huge part of my career. Cool. I do that with this guy named Carl Franks, who's absolutely the best of the best. He is
nice.
And we're breaking a lot of new ground in that world, in my opinion.
Carl Franks.
Carl, yeah. He's, comes from the violin world, and I've convinced him that that wasn't challenging enough. And now we're working. We've done a lot of huge restorations. Hauser, Boucher, we did a little work on a Torres. You know,
let's go play those guitars.
Sure,
let's go. Thanks so much for coming in, Aaron.
Right on. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, what a pleasure.
That's it for my conversation with Aaron Green. What a wonderful guy. You know, I thought that was what a lot of people want. A lot of you guys are always, not a lot, but some of you were like, you know, I wish he'd kind of stick to guitar talk, you know, be a little more professional about it. Well, there you go. We were on it. We were talking about it. I may not have sounded as intelligent as I know a lot of other people. You know, I always feel very intimidated when people start talking about the guitars, because I just don't, I don't go out there and seek out all these guitars like you guys do. I don't want to get into it. I'm always afraid that I'll get too wrapped up, and then I'll get fixated on the guitar, and I'll spend more money than I have. And you know, when I become a millionaire, which I'm sure I'm going to become rich and famous, I just don't know what at, but I'm pretty sure it's going to happen for me. And when it does, I'm going to buy the guitar, and I'll have more intelligent things to talk about with you guys. Hopefully, there's more intelligent conversation next time. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your patience. Thanks for your support. All right, guys, I'll see you next time.